Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 7. I'm going to do the entire chapter, chapter 7, verses 1 through 26. We're going to call this lesson, Driving Out the Nations. Moses is now giving a speech, his second discourse to the nation of Israel in the plains of Moab. Our context is this. In the last chapter, Deuteronomy 6, Moses, still giving his second discourse, told the Israelites what the greatest command was, which was to love God with all their heart, all their soul, and all their mind. So we start now in Deuteronomy 7:1. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess, Moses tells the Israelites, and he drives out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and powerful than you. Now these are the famous seven Canaanite nations. Now of course there are other lists where there are more than seven, but these seven right here are famous as these seven nations. In fact, I've got a map right here. It says these seven nations of Canaan. So we'll call them the seven nations of Canaan. I'm not going to go through each one individually. They're mentioned all through Genesis 10, Genesis 13, Exodus 3. But what I'm going to do is look at two maps and tell you where they are. First of all, we'll start with the Jebusites because they're all around Jerusalem. We all know where Jerusalem is, on the east side of the Dead Sea, right at the northern tip. So that's the Jebusites. And before I continue, I need to point out I've got two maps, and the maps don't exactly jibe. I think this represents the fact that scholars don't know exactly where these people are, but I'm going to do the best I can. So those are the Jebusites. Now, south of the Jebusites, on both maps, we have the Hittites. They would be at the west of the Dead Sea in the mountain range there near the southern end. Now, one map has north of these Hittites, east of those Hittites, Amorites, who are right along the edge of the Dead Sea on the western edge. One map does not have that. My first map has Amorites right to the north of the Jebusites, and the Perizzites are right there near Gaza, where the Philistines are located, the five cities of the Philistines. The Perizzites are there. Now, my other map has the Perizzites a little bit north of there, sharing the northern part of the land there between, say, Joppa and up to Tyre, where Caesarea was, Joppa, Caesarea, not Tyre, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said Tyre, should have said Dor, which is right before Carmel. That coastland there, the Canaanites owned. One map says the Canaanites shared that area with the Perizzites. Now, the Girgashites are sometimes, some scholars think the Girgashites are also the Gerasenes, as in the Gerasene demoniac, which is the area right to the west of the Sea of Galilee. So those two areas are the same from my two maps. The Hivites are at the very northern end of Israel, right north of Lake Hula. The two maps jibe on that. They jibe as far as Hivites being to the north of Lake Hula, but one map has some other Hivites right north of the Jebusites. Well, that's enough of that. I think I've told you by now that you can see there's not a lot of concurrent opinion on where all these tribes were, but they were scattered all out through the land of Israel. We go down to Deuteronomy 7, verses 2 through 5. And when the Lord your God delivers them over to you, and you defeat them, these seven nations, and you must completely destroy them, make no treaty with them, and show them no mercy. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons, or take their daughters for your sons, because they will take your sons away from me to worship other gods. This is the me is God. Take your sons away from me, Yahweh, to worship other gods. Then the Lord's anger will burn against you, and he will swiftly destroy you. Instead, this is what you are to do to them. Tear down their altars, smash their sacred pillars, cut down their Asherah poles, and burn up their carved images. Now in verse 2, God tells the Israelites make no treaty with the Canaanites. So that means no political alliances were allowed. And then he says in verse 3, do not intermarry with them. So no domestic alliances were allowed. Nothing. You don't have any truck with these people. They were destined for total and utter destruction. They were totally and utterly evil. We see in Deuteronomy 2, verse 34, and we took all his cities at that time and utterly destroyed the men and the women and the little ones of every city. We left none to remain. And that's talking about the battle with Sion and Og on the east side, or maybe it was the battle against Midian. But at any rate, the battle against the cities on the east side was a total war. Everything, men, women, and children. We'll talk about that in just a little bit, if that upsets your idea of God's justice. Now, in verse 3, when it says, do not intermarry with them, it's obvious the purpose was to prevent idolatry. It had nothing to do with racial differences because that command was not racially motivated. Now, there were some exceptions about intermarrying with foreigners. The Israelites could marry a foreigner if he or she became a proselyte. And also, the Israelites could marry captives taken in war. This is John Gill's point. Now, God said his anger would burn against Israel, and he would swiftly destroy Israel if they should intermarry or make political alliances with the Canaanites. Now, I'm going to read you a note from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown concerning the perennial question about the justice of the extermination of the Canaanites. And I'll summarize it before I read it. The Canaanites are so bad they all deserve to be exterminated. It's just as simple as that. There's no other way to explain it. Quote from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. This relentless doom of extermination which God denounced against those tribes of Canaan cannot be reconciled with the attributes of the divine character, except on the assumption that their gross idolatry and enormous wickedness left no reasonable hope of their repentance and amendment. If they were to be swept away like the antediluvians or the people of Sodom and Gomorrah as incorrigible sinners who had filled up the measure of their iniquities, it mattered not to them in what way the judgment was inflicted. And God, as the sovereign disposer, had a right to employ any instruments that pleased him for executing his judgments. After all, God did wipe out the world with Noah's flood. And then, of course, we know about Sodom and Gomorrah. People don't seem to think that was all unjust, but the world was totally evil, and the Canaanites were totally evil. Continuing with Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's quote, some think that they were to be exterminated as unprincipled usurpers of a country which God had assigned to the posterity of Eber, the Jews, and which had been occupied ages before by wandering shepherds of that race, kind of proto-Israelites. I don't buy that for a minute. Till on the migration of Jacob's family into Egypt through the pressure of famine, the Canaanites overspread the whole land, though they had no legitimate claim to it, and endeavored to retain possession of it by force. In this view, their expulsion was just and proper. Well, I think that's speculating. I think the easiest way to explain it is they were so evil, God had to wipe them out, or their evil would have spread and destroyed the rest of the human race. We go down to Deuteronomy 7, verses 6 through 9. For you are a holy people belonging to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be his own possession out of all the peoples on the face of the earth. The Lord was devoted to you and chose you, not because you were more numerous than all peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples, but because the Lord loved you and kept the oath he swore to your fathers. He brought you out with a strong hand and redeemed you from the place of slavery, from the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know that Yahweh your God is God, the faithful God who keeps his gracious covenant loyalty for a thousand generations with those who love him and keep his commands. So, in verse 6, Moses tells the people, you're a holy people. That means separated from corruption, the corruption of the world, and consecrated to God, as the NIV Study Bible says. That's a standard definition of holy. They're a holy people, dedicated to God despite all of their sin, kind of like the church. We're said to be holy and saints in the New Testament, but New Testament Christians do a lot of sin. We don't live up to our calling. The Lord your God has chosen you to be his own possession, as the Home of Christian Study Bible translates it. The NIV says, God has chosen you to be his treasured possession. I like that a little bit better. The King James has, God has chosen you to be his special people. Well, let's see about the treasured possession. Why were they treasured? Not because they were more numerous. They're actually very few. In fact, they were smaller in population than both the Egyptians and also the Canaanites. So it wasn't by great numbers that they ended up being a great people whose descendants were as the stars of the sky and the sands of the sea. The reason God chose them was because of his choice. It wasn't because of anything inherently praiseworthy in the Israelites. Well, verse 8, it was because the Lord loved the Israelites, loved you, kept the oath he swore to your fathers. Of course, that's the famous oath to Abraham. I will make your descendants, I will give you the land, and your descendants will be as numerous as the stars of the sky and the sands of the sea, and you will be, and your descendants will be a blessing to the nation. Genesis 15 and all those other places in Genesis in which that promise is given. And then, of course, Moses rehashes the Exodus because that was a big event in their lives. It happened 40 years before, and the preceding 40 years. They were slaves, and now they're not. So this is a big deal. God did that. He can also let you beat the Canaanites when you cross that river Jordan. Now, God is, the people of Israel are said to be a special possession. This is not the only place that that phrase is used. Exodus 19:5, I use the King James here. Now, therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then you shall be a peculiar treasure. I like that interesting translation, peculiar treasure, unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. but I'm choosing you. 1 Peter 2:9, but you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people. That's King James also. A peculiar treasure, a peculiar people. So the Old Testament is the antitype of the type of the Israelites. Peter, in fact, is quoting his verse word for word exactly from the Septuagint, God's own possession, and that's what the church is. And that's a comforting thought to hold on to when you look at the chaos that's in the world. Verse 9 says, God tells the people, know that Yahweh your God is God. Know, what does know mean? I remember I just read something about philosophers up until about 1960, epistemologists were saying that knowledge is justified true belief. If you have knowledge of something, the thing that you know has got to be true, and you got to believe it to be true, and you got to be able to give a reason for it. Now, I understand the philosophers don't like that definition anymore. Well, I want to tell you something. To me, the simple idea of know that God is God, you know that he saved you, that he redeemed you, that he's your deliverer, that he's going to give you eternal life. That's the kind of knowledge you can have with Jesus, certain knowledge, not philosophical knowledge. Know that the Lord is God, the faithful God who keeps his gracious covenant loyalty. Again, Moses refers back to the Abrahamic covenant. He says that covenant was 400 some odd years earlier, and it's going to be kept. In fact, it'll be kept for 1,000 generations, and 1,000 generations, of course, is not literally 1,000 generations because it's going to be kept forever as far as the Abrahamic covenant when it's fulfilled in the new covenant. 1,000 just means a long, long time. For example, Exodus 26, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me. Well, it's more than thousands of people that love God. It just means lots of. You take the number 10, which is the number of completeness, you cube it, which means you really amp it up on steroids, and you get a big number. It's not meant to be taken literally. Now in verse 8, it states that God has kept his gracious covenant with those who love him, but we need to remember that we were chosen because God loved us first, not vice versa. The Israelites also. In fact, that's what the verse says. It wasn't because you were great. It wasn't because you were strong, more numerous. He loved you because he loved you. He just chose you. Sort of the same thing we would say for individual Christians today. Deuteronomy 7:10, but he directly, that's God, directly pays back and destroys those who hate him. He will not hesitate to directly pay back the one who hates him. Well, we've just seen a lot of mercy from this God, this Yahweh, but now we're going to see a lot of retribution and vengeance and justice. Let's look at some other scriptures that have the wrath of God toward those who hate him. Leviticus 26:28, I will act with furious hostility towards you. I will also discipline you 7 times for your sins. That's not talking about pagans, that's talking about the Israelites. God will act with furious hostility towards you. Numbers 10:35. Whenever the ark set out, Moses would say, Arise, O Lord, let your enemies be scattered, and those who hate you flee from your presence. And there, the enemies of God are those who hate God, and they are scattered. Nahum 1:2, the Lord is a jealous and avenging God. The Lord takes vengeance and is fierce in wrath. The Lord takes vengeance against his foes. He is furious with his enemies. It is a terribly frightful thing to fall into the hands of our God, who is a consuming fire, as the author of Hebrews has it. Now, what does this verse mean when it says God will not hesitate to directly pay back the one who hates him? John Gill says that word directly means openly, publicly, and at once. In other words, he's not going to mess around before he lowers the boom. We go now to Deuteronomy 7:11-12. So keep the command, the statutes, and ordinances that I'm giving you to follow today. If you listen to and are careful to keep these ordinances, the Lord your God will keep his covenant loyalty with you as he swore to your fathers. This is Moses still speaking. Again, he's continuing with the theme of his second discourse, which is to obey the commandments. The second discourse talked about what the law was, and then Moses then goes on, especially in chapter 6, and now here in chapter 7, he goes on and on and on with, keep this law, obey it, follow it. And then if you do that, the Lord your God will keep his covenant loyalty with you. Notice this condition there. Remember Deuteronomy 27, some curses, then Deuteronomy 28, some blessings, and then the end of Deuteronomy 28, some more curses. That's the Mosaic covenant. It's conditional. You better keep it or bad things are going to happen. You keep it and some very good things are going to happen. And this is what Moses is talking about, his own Mosaic covenant. Now, Abraham's covenant, at least as far as the people are concerned, is unconditional because his descendants will fill the earth as the sands of the seashore, because Abraham's covenant was fulfilled in the New Testament church. Not as far as the land is concerned, of course. That was conditional and temporary. But the land was just a type. The antitype is the kingdom of God, and that goes on forever and ever. So Abraham's covenant was unconditional, but Moses' covenant was conditional. If you are careful to keep these ordinances, the Lord your God will keep his covenant loyalty with you. By the way, a lot of people get into big arguments about this, especially Reformed people. Is the covenant of Moses conditional or unconditional? And they go on and on. I don't know what is so complicated about that. Moses' covenant is conditional. It says so right here. If you listen and keep, the Lord will keep. And how does God keep his covenant, as the Holman Christian Study Bible has it, keep his covenant loyalty with Israel? Well, all you have to do is read the blessings in Deuteronomy 28, 1 through 14. That's how he's going to keep the covenant loyalty. I'm not going to read those, but there are a lot of good things, mainly prosperity, lots of cows, lots of sheep, lots of rain. We go down to Deuteronomy 7, verses 13 through 15. He, that's God, Moses is still relaying God's, is still talking about God's attitude toward his people. He, Yahweh, will love you, bless you, and multiply you. He will bless your descendants and the produce of your land, your grain, new wine and oil, the young of your herds and the newborn of your flocks. In the land he swore to your fathers that he would give you, you will be blessed above all peoples. There will be no infertile male or female among you or your livestock. The Lord will remove all sickness from you. He will not put on you all the terrible diseases of Egypt that you know about, but he will inflict them on all who hate you. Now, this multiplication of people, again, that's the numerous descendants as the stars of heaven and dust on the earth that we've talked about a lot. Moses is just repeating that. God's going to multiply you. He will bless your descendants. Verse 15, he mentions some of the blessings of the covenant, grain, new wine, oil, you know, the herds, newborn of the flocks, and all that, and the land. You will be blessed above all peoples. Now, it says there will be no infertile male or female among your livestock. Psalms 128, verse 3 says, thy wife shall be as a fruitful vine by the sides of thine house, thy children like olive plants round about thy tables. So the people are going to be fruitful. So that's part of the blessing. Now, I tend to take these blessings as talking about Israel as a whole. It doesn't mean there's not going to be an individual infertile woman amongst Israel throughout its covenant history. And if there is, you can always say, well, that's because the people disobeyed or the individual person disobeyed. But I think you got to be real careful about that. Just in general, things are going to be rolling along fine. Lots of offspring if they will just obey the covenant. And notice it's not only the people that have no infertility, but the livestock. The women won't be barren and the cows won't be barren. Verse 15 says, the Lord will remove all sickness from you. Again, that word all can mean all without exception, or it can mean all in the sense of a great many. That is a incredible promise. Does that mean every single disease? Now, of course, as I said, all can mean a lot of or many, so he removed many sicknesses from you. But I will point this out. The new covenant is considered to be better than the old covenant, at least if you read the book of Hebrews. In general, it's better. So if God promises this under the Mosaic covenant to remove all sicknesses, what does that imply about the New Testament covenant, the new covenant? Oh, I know, Kenneth Copeland and Benny Hinn, and there's a bunch of fake people out there claiming about healing all the time. Justin Peters starts dripping saliva from the corners of his mouth as he starts to tear into these heretics. Well, fine, but that's easy fruit. You can abusus non tollit usum. The abuse does not bar the use. And just because people have abused the promise of healing doesn't mean it's not in the New Testament. If sickness is just there, it's not an evil thing, it's just there to build your character, then why do you go to the doctor? You go to the doctor to get rid of the sickness. Why would we not go to Jesus for the same reason? And if God in the Old Covenant promised all sickness to be removed from the people, I just wonder that maybe the charismatics might have been right, saying that God, that I know they're right about healing being in the atonement, because Jesus himself in Matthew 8 heals some people. Then he says, and then Matthew says, so that it might be fulfilled of Isaiah the prophet that he bore our sicknesses. That's physical sicknesses there, not just emotional sicknesses. So I think we need to be a little bit more positive about divine healing in the New Testament, especially during these days of pandemic. Notice that God will put on people the terrible diseases of Egypt if people are disobedient to him. Well, at least that's implied. Well, it does say that. It's not implied. It says it. But he will inflict them all on who hate you, all the terrible diseases of Egypt. So God can use sickness as a punishment. And I suppose he can use sickness for an erring Christian. Although, of course, we've got to be careful. Not all disease is caused by sickness, of course. A lot of disease is caused just because we live in a fallen world. But you have to give God the discretion where he can do that kind of thing. It says right here that people that don't obey his covenant, by golly, he will inflict them, those terrible diseases on Egypt, on those who hate God. What were the terrible diseases of Egypt? That's probably the 10 plagues that are so famous. Jamison Fawcett and Brown says, nah, it's probably diseases that are peculiar to Egypt. Here's what Jamison Fawcett and Brown say, quote, that country has some indigenous maladies which are very malignant, such as ophthalmia, dysentery, smallpox, and the plague. Well, there's a lot of other countries that got the same things. Europe's got all that, except I don't know what ophthalmia is. But whatever, bad stuff if you turn on God and hate him. We go down to Deuteronomy 7, verse 16. You must destroy all the peoples the Lord your God is delivering over to you, and do not look on them with pity. This is Moses talking to the people still. Do not worship their gods, for that will be a snare to you. Now let's look at that word destroy. I here take note of a big so-called ethical problem that skeptics always raise. How can a just God steal these peace-loving, sweet people's lands? Well, the answer to that is they weren't sweet people. They were idolaters and child sacrificers and murderers, and their cup of iniquity had run over, and they were judged for their sin and rebellion against the Almighty God. That's why the Israelites were to destroy all the peoples in Canaan. Again, this is similar to what happened on the eastern side. Well, actually, let me repeat Deuteronomy 7:2. When the Lord your God delivers them over to you and you defeat them, you must completely destroy them. So basically, verse 16 is repetition of verse 2. Twice he says, destroy them. Don't look on them with pity, because I don't care who you are. It's hard to kill men, women, and children. Maybe not so hard in battle, but boy, when you got them caught, there's no POW camps. You can't really send them back to their homeland because they don't have a homeland. So they killed them. Deuteronomy 7:17-19. If you say to yourself, these nations are greater than I, how can I drive them out? Do not be afraid of them. Be sure to remember what the Lord your God did to Pharaoh and all Egypt. The great trials that you saw, the signs and wonders, the strong hand and outstretched arm by which the Lord your God brought you out. The Lord your God will do the same to all the peoples you fear. Verse 17 says, if you say to yourself, these nations are greater than I, well, John Gill says, well, yeah, they are greater. Quote, 7-1, and perhaps any one of them as powerful as Israel. Each Canaanite tribe was probably bigger than Israel and more powerful. And you put all 7 of them together. Now, of course, the Israelites didn't fight them all at once. The Canaanites did not ally themselves against Israel. They fought them piecemeal, thank goodness. They knocked them off in succession. But anyway, God says, don't be afraid. And again, look back to what he's already done. Remember what happened to Pharaoh in Egypt? God did that to them. Remember the great trials. That would be the 7 plagues. Excuse me, the 10 plagues. Those 10 plagues are called trials also in Deuteronomy 4:34. Or has a God attempted to go and take a nation as his own out of another nation by trials, signs, wonders, and war? The trials were the 10 plagues. They were a trial to Egypt. I guess they were a trial to Israel too, because they had to live in the land of Egypt while the trials were going on, the plagues. Now, this idea of remembering what God had done in the past, it's a big theme in Deuteronomy. Now, this is such a big theme. I'm going to try to go through a whole ton of verses very quickly so that you will be inundated with the idea that that the Israelites were supposed to recall what God had already done. The application, of course, is we Christians need to recall what God has done for us. Deuteronomy 5:15, you shall remember that you were slave in the land of Egypt. Deuteronomy 4:10, remember the day you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb. Deuteronomy 8:2, you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness. Deuteronomy 8:18, but you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who is giving you the power to make wealth. Deuteronomy 9:7, remember, do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. Deuteronomy 9:27, remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Deuteronomy 15:15, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Deuteronomy 16:3, you shall not eat leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat with it unleavened bread, the bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, so that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. Passover itself was a memorial of their exiting Egypt. Deuteronomy 16:12, you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt. Deuteronomy 24:9, remember what the Lord your God did to Miriam. Deuteronomy 24:18, but you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt. Deuteronomy 24:22, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Deuteronomy 25:17, remember what Amalek did to you along the way. Deuteronomy 32:7, remember the days of old, consider the years of all generations. 14 remember verses besides the one we're on. I think the lesson is clear. We need to remember what God has done in the past and don't forget him. Don't take him for granted. And of course, the point of all this remembering was to know that the Lord your God will do the same to all the peoples you fear. If you remember back what happened in Egypt, the Egyptians were whopped, and God's going to do the same thing to the Canaanites. So don't be afraid. Just remember what's already gone on before. Deuteronomy 7 verses 20 through 22. The Lord your God will also send the hornet against them until all the survivors and those hiding from you perish. Don't be terrified of them, for the Lord your God, a great and awesome God, is among you. The Lord your God will drive out these nations before you little by little. You will not be able to destroy them all at once, otherwise the wild animals will become too numerous for you. Verse 20. Moses says that God's going to send a hornet against the seven Canaanite nations. If you think about it, well, if you've ever dealt with a hornet, as I have, they chase you, and they're nasty, and if they sting you, you will wish that you had not gotten up that morning. And they're aggressive. They don't just buzz around. They come right at you. You don't ever want to get a hornet mad at you. That's why we have that metaphor, mad as a hornet. And so this is a great metaphor. Exodus 23:28, I will send the hornet in front of you, and it will drive the Hivites, Canaanites, and Hittites away from you. That was told earlier. I think it was to Moses. And Moses is saying again, he's saying yet again, hey, the hornet's going to be in front of us, going to drive the bad guys away. This is also, this idea about the hornet is repeated in Joshua 24, verse 12. I sent the hornet ahead of you, and it drove out the two Amorite kings before you. It was not by your sword or bow. So a hornet is a symbol of God being in the front of the Israelites and scaring the patuki out of Israel's enemies. The two Amorite kings, of course, who had to face that metaphorical hornet, or Sihon of Heshbon and Og of Bashan. Now, when did this happen, or when will it happen? Verse 20, the Lord your God will also send the hornet against them. Well, there's some options on that. The NIV Study Bible suggests it might have been a concrete historical event that happened later. But if it is, we don't know what historical event it was, or it could be just a metaphor. The Israelites are buzzing the Canaanites. I tend to take it that way. It was just a metaphor. It's a great metaphor. Now, verse 21 says that this great and awesome God, Yahweh, is among you. Well, if you think about it, that was literally true because God was living in the tabernacle, which was always placed in the center of the camp, as John Gill says. Verse 22, the Lord your God will drive out these nations before you little by little. Why did the Israelites not just go in and one big bang wipe them all out? John Gill says it may have been in the power of the Israelites to wipe the Canaanites out all at once, although I question that. We've already seen that the Israelites were outnumbered by a good bit. But even if they had the power to do it, it wasn't wise, because if they had done that, they would have wiped out all civilization. There wouldn't be any fields anymore. There wouldn't be any aqueducts or trenches or whatever was the farming infrastructure that had been done by the Canaanites would be completely gone, wiped out. As a result, wild beasts would multiply and then take over the land. As Moses explicitly says here in the end of verse 22, don't destroy them all at once, otherwise the wild animals will become too numerous for you. And another point to be made is that the Israelites were not yet sufficient enough, populous enough, to fill the whole land. And so, no people, a vacuum, then come the lions. The wild beasts would fill up the empty space. John Gill and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown both suggest that if the Israelites had gone in and beaten the Canaanites all at once, the unburied carcasses of the Canaanites would attract wild beasts. Well, I think that's a stretch. We go now to Deuteronomy 7, verses 23 through 26, and we'll finish up this audio. The Lord your God will give them over to you and throw them into great confusion until they are destroyed. He will hand their kings over to you, and you will wipe them and you will wipe out their names under heaven. No one will be able to stand against you. You will annihilate them. You must burn up the carved images of their gods. Don't covet the silver and gold on the images and take it for yourself, or else you will be ensnared by it, for it is abhorrent to the Lord your God. You must not bring any abhorrent thing into your house, or you will be set apart for destruction like it. You are to utterly detest and abhor it, because it is set apart for destruction. Now, in verse 24, God says he's going to hand their kings over to the Israelites. Now, you might think there's seven kings because there's seven nations, but actually there were 31 kings. Joshua 12:24 says this, the king of Tirzah 1 This is in a list of kings. And then the summary of the list says this in Joshua 12:24, all the kings, 30 and one. So obviously these were tribes with petty little kings. Their power was not absolutely concentrated into one monarch for each tribe. The Israelites had to burn up the idols. Moses has already said that in verse 5 of this chapter. Instead, this is what you are to do to them. Tear down their altars, smash their sacred pillars, cut down their Asherah poles, and burn up their carved images. Asherah is poles that were planted in the ground to worship Astarte, the Phoenician goddess of fertility from which we get our Astarte eggs, Easter eggs. The Israelites are told not to covet the silver and gold on the images. That's probably either clothes that the images were made to wear, fancy garments. Most probably, I think it's just the images had a wooden substructure, and then the idolaters would hammer plates of silver and gold over the substructure, thus making the idol. And notice in verse 26, you must not bring any abhorrent thing into your house, or you will be set apart for destruction. You couldn't even put it in your house. You are utterly detest and abhor it. Well, you recall the story of Achan when they went into the promised land. Let's read that. Joshua 6:17-19. But the city and everything in it are set apart to the Lord for destruction. Just like Moses has said here, Joshua's carrying that out. Only Rahab the prostitute and everyone with her in the house will live because she hid the men we set. We're not going to kill Rahab, of course. But keep yourselves from the things set apart or you will be set apart for destruction. Just like Moses had said here. If you take any of those things, you will set apart the camp of Israel for destruction and bring disaster on it. For all the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron are dedicated to the Lord must go into the Lord's treasury. Korban, in other words, all dedicated stuff. Joshua 7:1. The Israelites, however, were unfaithful regarding the things set apart for destruction. Achan, famous guy, Achan, son of Carmi, blah, 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 took some of what was set apart, and the Lord's anger burned against the Israelites. Drop down to verse 20, Joshua 7. Achan replied to Joshua, it is true, I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel. This is what I did. When I saw among the spoils a beautiful cloak from Babylon, 20 silver shekels and a bar of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and took them. You can see for yourself, they're concealed in the ground inside my tent with the money under the cloak. So Joshua sent messengers who ran to the tent, and there was the cloak concealed in his tent with the money underneath. They took the things from inside the tent, brought them to Joshua and all the Israelites, and spread them out in the Lord's presence. Then Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan, son of Zerah, the silver, the cloak, the bar of gold, his sons and daughters, his ox, donkey, and sheep, his tent, and all that he had, and brought them up to the valley of Achor. Joshua said, why have you troubled us? Today the Lord will trouble you. So all Israel stoned them to death. They burned their bodies, threw stones on them. So you see, the Israelites were very big on this, not taking idols into your house. That gold and silver was dedicated, Korban, and was supposed to go to the temple treasury. And what cost Achan and his family's life was the fact that he was covetous. The love of money is the root of all evil, as they say. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished chapter 7 of Deuteronomy, driving out the nations. Next time, we will go into Deuteronomy 8, the entire chapter, verses 1 through 20, and we'll entitle that, at least tentatively now, we will entitle that audio, Remember the Lord Your God. I've already talked about remembering a lot in this section. See you next time. Hope you enjoyed this audio.